Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 16th. This week we went to downtown New York City to visit with Dr. Daniel P. Salmazi, who has an article in the current issue called Then There Was One, which is about the story of Catholic healthcare in New York and what lessons it can hold for the rest of the country. I met Dr. Salmazi, who's also a Franciscan brother, in his offices at St. Vincent Hospital. Hello, this is Tim Reedy. I'm here joined by Dr. Daniel Salmazi, the Director of Ethics at St. Vincent's Medical Center and New York Medical College. Welcome, Dr. Salmazi.
Happy to be here.
Dr. Salmazi has an article in the current issue of America about healthcare in New York City and looking at what happened here over the last few years for lessons in the rest of the country for Catholic healthcare. Now, we can start with this basic story. In 2007, there were 8 Catholic hospitals in New York City. By the end of 2008, there was only one. What exactly happened?
Well, one of the most stunning things that I find is that most people aren't even aware that this actually happened. And that in itself, I think, is very interesting and part of why I think the story needs to be told. There was a merger between St. Vincent's Hospital Manhattan, St. Vincent's Staten Island, which were both run by the Sisters of Charity of New York, and then the previously merged hospitals of the Diocese of Brooklyn. That whole merger went into bankruptcy. It turned out to be an absolute financial disaster. And as a part of coming out of bankruptcy, they had to sell off or close a number of those hospitals. Of course, the ones that were closed were the ones that were most mission sensitive, actually serving in the poorest neighborhoods. No one wanted to buy them. And as that was happening, the Archdiocese of New York was simultaneously, and the Archdiocese wasn't part of this merger, they were busy selling off their hospitals, and so that some have been sold to secular institutions. One was sold to, or was actually brought under St. Vincent's to run, and then closed by something called the Berger Commission, which was in the process of closing down hospitals that it thought were not functioning very well or really not needed. And then one other Catholic hospital in New York City, Cabrini, was then closed by this commission as well. And so between 2007 and 2008, suddenly from 8 hospitals, we went down to one, St. Vincent's Hospital Manhattan.
Now, that's where we are right now at St. Vincent's down in Greenwich Village. Now, New York is obviously a very competitive environment for hospitals. There were too many beds, and it seems like the Catholic hospitals, the one that were the ones that were the first on sort of the chopping block, as it were. Is it because private hospitals, teaching hospitals, those were there were no cuts made there?
Yes. Well, the biggest hospitals, I mean, nobody in their right mind is going to think that Columbia or Cornell or NYU is going to be closed down. And then there are a number of other hospitals that are run by the city. The city of New York has more municipal hospitals than any other city in the country. Most don't even have any anymore. They've privatized them or closed them. And they're very politically connected, as you might imagine, strong union representation, local politicians supporting them. And what's left were basically small private hospitals, most of which were Catholic, at least the ones that had the poorest political connections. And those were the ones that went.
Now, you mentioned in your article that in some ways this is a sign of the progress of the Catholic community. These hospitals were built at a time when the Catholic Church was building its own institutions from schools to colleges to hospitals because of some of the anti-Catholic sentiment, and there was the idea that you had to have your own hospitals. But you make the case in your article that it's important even in this day and age for the Catholic Church to stay in healthcare despite the challenges it faces. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, obviously it's difficult to do this. There's no question, and I'm sure a lot of bishops will spend a lot of sleepless nights trying to keep a hospital going in their own diocese, and certainly the sisters groups that run many of these have been doing just that for many years, having a difficult time keeping their systems going. And maybe it is good that we don't have to, be in Catholic ghettos for our health care. But I think if we really respect diversity, if we really think that diversity in health care has a meaning, then it doesn't mean that everything is homogenized and does the same. Catholic hospitals, I think, provide something that's really unique. I mean, people, when they come to this hospital, I think, for instance, really sense something different about the place, an ethos about the place, so that even when we don't have the sisters, we have the graduates of the nursing school and something of their charism that's been passed down to the nurses who are here, a compassionate sense, a mission-driven sense that I think is important to keep within healthcare. That's very different in terms of, I think, a holistic approach to healthcare, caring for the person as spiritual as well as physical. These are things that people seem to actually want in healthcare, and Catholics ought to be able to provide that in spades. The other thing that is important in Catholic healthcare is that we have a place that we say it's actually credible in the 21st century to do all the most sophisticated technological things that you could imagine and still be faithful to our moral commitments. If we have an institution that does that, that says that that's real, it is in that sense incarnational. Otherwise, it's just theory.
Right. That's interesting. You're in the field of bioethics, and as you point out in your article, it seems particularly important for the church, which is so committed to this field, to have someplace, a laboratory almost, to work out some of these ideas.
Very much so. So that if we want to continue to sort of say that healthcare ought not to have abortion as part of what it does, then it's good to have institutions that don't do abortions, and we'd be preeminent among those kinds of institutions that can actually do that. I think another reason to keep Catholic hospitals around in terms of our advocacy for the poor. To be a bishop and say at the sidelines, without any hospitals or any involvement in healthcare, that we think it's important to care for the poor might be good, but to be a bishop who goes to the governor and says, 30% of the hospital beds in your state are run by Catholics. We're struggling very hard to carry out our mission to care for the poor. We're doing good work for this state and its citizens, and we need your help, and we need to do a better job of doing that. It makes a big difference.
Now, your article, as we discussed, addresses the situation in New York, but perhaps you can point to other models, other dioceses where a different approach has worked for Catholic health care.
Yes, I in the article quote the scripture that says that we ought to be wily as snakes and innocent as doves, and I think that healthcare is a place where that aphorism of Jesus really gets put to the test, because I think that it is true that people have to be very creative and clever. I think what we need are lots of people who are committed to Catholic healthcare and its values, and also at the same time crackerjacks in terms of business management, and also able to be politically savvy and plugged in. Doing that's not easy. There's no question about that. But where has this worked, and where have people done it? I think there are systems, for instance, in which they manage to function as a coherent system, and to have, let's say, a hospital that is in the poor neighborhood in the inner city, and caring for lots of undocumented, uninsured individuals, linked to a system that also has within it very prosperous hospitals that, let's say, are in the suburbs and doing lots of open heart surgery, which makes a lot of money for if the patients are insured, and then in a very Catholic way pool their resources so that the whole system stays afloat. And I think that that's one way that people can try to put together a system where we work collectively together for the common good.
Maybe we can circle back to the story of New York, and perhaps you can comment on what lessons this story, what happened in 2007, 2008, holds for Catholic healthcare in other places in this country.
I think it actually has lessons that even go beyond healthcare. I think one of those, for instance, is that we really ought to actually, as a Catholic institution, be able to work. As Catholic institutions be able to work together, it's odd in some ways how one of the reasons that the system failed in New York City was that the institutions were not able to work with each other. You'd think that an institution named St. Joseph's and another one named St. Mary's would be able to get along, but they actually don't. And in some ways, with a naive sense of trying to protect their charism and not being swallowed up by another and sort of petty jealousies, I think those sorts of things are real problems for us. And if we were truly Catholic, we would be able to work together. Secondly, I think there are ways in which we continue to operate as if this was the 1950s. I mean, there are a lot of the better systems, I think, have been proactive and thought that, well, the sisters aren't going to be here forever, and we have to now get business managers who are steeped in the charism and really even formed in the charism and able to work as the business leaders of these very sophisticated, complex institutions, but still be committed to the Catholic identity and the religious identity of the founding order. But in a lot of places, and New York in particular, a lot of that sort of thing was slow to happen, and people acted as if the sisters would be here forever. I think we sometimes also have people who float to the top of Catholic institutions just because they're good Catholics rather than really good managers. I think sometimes that that the church leadership is put in a funny position these days in which they succeed by actually not failing. And when that happens, there's really no incentive to really be out there at the forefronts fighting to keep a hospital afloat. No one's going to reward somebody in the hierarchy, for instance, for keeping a Catholic hospital open. What happens, though, is that hospitals and other institutions, schools are like this too, can get bad press. For a Catholic hospital, somebody can come along and start protesting that you're doing something at the hospital that violates Catholic teaching. They suck a lot of time out of church leadership energy, and also are very costly. And it seems like they're only liabilities when in fact, we ought to be able to find creative ways to make them really powerful centers of witness for the faith in our institutions in sophisticated cities like New York.
You sort of anticipated my next question, which is what lessons does the New York story hold for Catholic institutions in general? And as you point out in the article, one of the points is that we're not doing enough fundraising for these institutions. We're not supporting them as Catholics. We're not supporting colleges, hospitals enough. So one way is, just our monetary support.
Yes, I think that another example here is that there were other hospitals in New York City, which in this very competitive market were similarly stressed. Mount Sinai, for instance, a few years ago was in terrible financial distress, but was able to look to its philanthropic community for support. Ironically, Catholics complain a lot about not having influence in the culture, but Catholic philanthropy has not been very good at supporting institutions. Our universities are really incredibly underendowed. Well, maybe these days all universities are underendowed in the market, but still, compared to similar institutions, remarkably underendowed. And it's not as if Catholics are still poor immigrants anymore. Many Catholics are making lots of money in business, in the financial world, and have not been very forthcoming in terms of philanthropic support for institutions. Catholics are typically pretty good at giving money to direct service to the poor, not as good in terms of supporting Catholic universities, Catholic hospitals, and if they then turn around and say, well, we don't have any influence on the culture, I think there's a good reason why we don't. It's because we don't support our institutions.
Well, maybe we can end on this question. I mean, other than monetary support, which is, of course, very important, what can the average Catholic do to support health care in their local city or town?
Well, I think taking an interest in your Catholic institutions is a good way to start. There are ways in which any hospital could use volunteers. So if people want to join the volunteer staff of hospitals, be part of fundraising for those institutions, come to them for your health care. Maybe be creative. Think about whether within your parish you want to sort of say, well, we want to start a parish nursing program in our institution, and we'll do that in conjunction with our local Catholic hospital. I think there are a myriad of ways we could do this if we're actually creative about it and sincere in our interest in keeping these institutions going.
I said that was the final question, but I have one more. One of the unique things about St. Vincent's the Catholic Hospital is that it has this Department of Ethics, which you helped to run. So maybe you can just describe briefly to our listeners, what does the Department of Ethics in a Catholic institution do?
We're unique, I think, at St. Vincent's in that we're actually a clinical department. I tease people sometimes that it's a little like Liechtenstein having a rotating seat on the Security Council, but I actually sit on the Medical Executive Committee of our hospital, right with the Chair of Surgery, Medicine, Pediatrics, etc. And that itself, I think, speaks volumes about the commitment of an institution to ethics, because I'm at the table for those kinds of decisions at that sort of top level. But in addition, we do ethics consults. So if people have a question about whether to discontinue life support on somebody, or, you know, strange ones that come up, and they're more and more all the time as the technology approaches, can I get a sperm sample from my brain-dead boyfriend who just, who's about to have their life support stopped? Those kinds of questions are puzzling to people, and sometimes they think they're well-intentioned and are good, but we have to be prepared to help people struggle with these kinds of questions. And then we do teaching. We teach the staff, we teach the medical students at New York Medical College, and we do research. We do empirical studies about ethics, we do philosophical, theological work, and try to educate the public as well. So we do a lot, and again, I think that to do that in a Catholic institution makes the place of ethics within the secular world more real. Because if I'm sitting as a priest or lay person in an institution that has nothing to do with education of medical students or the care of patients, and I complain about the ethical problems that are happening in the world, it's not going to influence the world so much as if I am an educator training the new doctors, training the people who are working in an institution, and writing out of the experience of being someone who does patient care, research, teaching. That makes it all the more credible and all the more likely to be influential.
Well, we want to thank Dr. Dansel Macy, Director of Ethics here at St. Vincent's, also a Franciscan brother. Well, thank you and good luck with your work.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Glad to be with you.
I want to thank you again for joining us for the American Magazine podcast. Just a reminder that you can respond to our conversations by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. We're happy to announce that you can now play our podcast directly from our homepage by simply going to americamagazine.org. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.